Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you on this Thursday, the 9th of June. Welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority is set to appeal the reopening of more than 700 corruption charges against President Jacob Zuma. The opposition says Zuma should be brought to book.
The only reason why Mr. Zuma is not yet in jail is because he's kept up every state institution that has power to put him there.
And following violent protests, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta says Parliament will form a bipartisan committee to discuss the future of the Electoral Commission.
Our friends in the court coalition will also do their part, and all of us participate in a peaceful, fair, open and transparent manner to be able to all give our views and to give this country direction on this most critical matter.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority, the NPA, is set to appeal the reopening of more than 700 corruption charges against President Jacob Zuma. If the NPA fails in their appeal, Zuma will find himself facing charges which he probably believed had long since been buried. The appeal is expected to be heard in Pretoria today. Subri Govender reports.
The decision to appeal against the reinstatement of the charges by the NPA and Zuma has been met with criticism. Lawson Naidu is the executive director of the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution.
This is, as I say, really a matter of delaying the process, to delay the moment at which the NPA have to actually take a decision to reinstitute the 783 fraud and corruption charges against the president.
Professor Pierre DeVos, a legal expert based at the University of Cape Town, is also critical of the NPA. Professor DeVos believes that neither the NPA nor Zuma will succeed in getting the Pretoria High Court's ruling overturned.
I would be extremely surprised if the Supreme Court of Appeal is going to allow the appeal and is going to grant the National Prosecuting Authority's application. Unless the SAA changes its already decided case law, I can't see that it's going to be successful.
The charges of fraud, corruption, racketeering and money laundering were first brought against Jacob Zuma by the NPA in 2006 after he was sacked as deputy president by former President Thabo Mbeki in 2005. Mbeki sacked Zuma after his financial advisor, Shabir Sheikh, was sentenced to 15 years in jail. The presiding judge, Hilary Squires, found that there was a symbiotic and fraudulent relationship between Sheikh and Zuma. Musi Maimani is the leader of the opposition Democratic Alliance, which has pursued a seven-year battle for Zuma to be charged.
You see, we've forgotten how Mr. Sheikh solicited bribes for Mr. Zuma and how he wrote off debt for Mr. Zuma. We've forgotten how Mr. Sheikh, or Shabir Sheikh, was sentenced for 15 years in prison for corruption and 3 years for fraud, for what Judge Hilary Squires called a mutually beneficial symbiosis with Jacob Zuma. The only reason why Mr. Zuma is not yet in jail is because he's kept up every state institution that has power to put him there.
But despite the vociferous calls for Zuma to have his day in court, the beleaguered South African president is still maintaining his innocence. And he's being supported by the ruling ANC, even if this support at this stage is not 100%. South Africans, therefore, are eagerly awaiting the Supreme Court of Appeal's response to the appeal by the NPA and Zuma and their efforts to stop the charges against Zuma from being reinstituted.
Subri Govender, so what impact is this latest court case likely to have on Zuma's presidency? Isaac Mugabe put that question to Patrick Bond, political economist at the University of KwaZulu-Natal.
No matter what seems to be happening in the courts, in parliament and in everyday life, Jacob Zuma seems very committed to going through at least to the end of 2017, when there will be a new president of the party. It could either be his wife, ex-wife, whose name is Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, the outgoing head of the African Union, or his deputy, Cyril Ramaphosa. My gut feeling is that Jacob Zuma will stay in power at least through then and possibly through the middle of 2019 when his 10-year term comes to an end.
What does this tell us about South Africa's judicial system when it comes to trying big shots of Zuma's status?
The current ways in which Jacob Zuma has been able to get off, not only from his paying for the rural palace that was partially built with government funds, it's just delaying tactics. The delaying tactics sometimes run out. So the most recent problem has been when 783 cases of corruption that were filed back in 2009, and the then prosecutor didn't bring them to the courts. We feel, I think, in South Africa that there's a civil war underway played out by professionals, by lawyers, prosecutors, and the politicians are looking on and pulling some strings here and there and really getting away with quite a lot of blatant corruption.
Then, is there a true separation of powers in South Africa, especially that a cross-section of the people think Zuma should not still be president of the country after he violated the constitution? What do you think?
Well, we haven't got reliable polling to understand the broad society's feelings about whether Zuma should step aside. The African National Congress very carefully manages these perceptions. The only thing that will really tell us whether Jacob Zuma is taking his party down is the August 3rd municipal government election. So all over South Africa, these municipal elections will be a signal as to whether people have given up on reform of the ANC from within. And in at least four of the major metropolitan areas, it may be that a next government in this country can be identified by the trends that we see on August 3rd in the municipal elections. And Jacob Zuma certainly is pulling down the popularity of the ruling party. How far remains to be seen.
Patrick Bond from the University of KwaZulu-Natal.
Africa Link, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
And now to Kenya, where President Uhuru Kenyatta has said that Parliament will form a bipartisan committee to discuss the future of the country's electoral commission, the IEBC. The opposition claims the commission is biased towards the government and should be dissolved. Protests against the IEBC turned violent earlier this week and two people were killed. Kenyatta said he has held talks with religious leaders and the speakers of the Senate and Parliament to decide on the way forward. Isaac Mugabe asked our Nairobi correspondent James Shimanyula whether he thought this latest initiative would bring the opposition's protests to an end.
Given that the president has made the announcement, it looks clearly that he has listened to the religious leaders and indeed agreed with them that this is the time to take action so that the committee can talk about the way forward on the IBC's future. Let's hear President Kenyatta speaking about the formation of the committee that will talk about the IEBC affair.
Our friends in the court coalition will also do their part to accede to this manner of handling this situation, which is clearly set out in our rules and regulations, and all of us participate in a peaceful, fair, open and transparent manner to be able to all give our views and to give this country direction on this most critical matter.
That was Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. And just to inform you is that today, Thursday, before noon or shortly after noon, the president is going to meet the committee and then go through the areas that need to be talked about and then things will move from there.
The opposition says it will respond this Thursday after studying the statement. What's your reading on this?
The opposition leader Raila Odinga has responded positively to what President Kenyatta said in his announcement and even added a rider to the extent that that is precisely what he has been saying should be done. Sit down, both sides, and discuss the future of the IEBC.
This is a welcome development. We already have set up our side of our team, two senators and three members of the National Assembly.
Raila Odinga, leader of Kenya's opposition CORD alliance. Earlier, you heard James Shimanyula in Nairobi talking to Isaac Mugabe. Authorities in South Sudan have formed a committee to review President Salva Kiir's controversial decision to expand the number of states that make up the country from 10 to 28. The decision was taken last October. Officials say the committee has been given 30 days to submit its findings to the cabinet. Wahi Simon Wudu reports from the capital, Juba.
When President Kiir gave the decree to create the 28 new states last October, he argued that his decision was meant to bring services closer to the people. This happened 2 months after the signing of the Compromise Peace Agreement, which was meant to end the conflict in South Sudan. The peace deal was signed on the basis of 10 states. Nyarji Roman, deputy spokesman in the office of the first vice president Riek Machar, says the committee formed has been tasked to review how cost-effective the idea of having 28 states is.
The committee will sit and verify the borders of the states and the possibility of implementing the 28 states. And they will also come up with the numbers of the state that they will think that is going to be possible for the government of the national unity to implement.
The committee comprises of 15 members, all drawn from Kiir and Machar's parties, other political parties, and the international community. Roman says the committee is expected to come up with ways forward that will help lessen challenges that have emerged as a result of the creation of the 28 states.
It is obviously that the government currently is facing a serious economic crisis, and we hope that the committee will come up with a solution that we can be easily implemented without any challenges.
Some of the challenges that have emerged after the creation of the 28 states are payment of civil servants and rising tensions among ethnic communities due to unclear demarcated borders. There has been widespread criticism over the creation of the additional states. Some say it is a politically motivated move, while others say economically having 28 states makes no sense at a time when the country is facing daunting socio-economic and political challenges. Lam Akol, chair of Democratic Change, one of the opposition political parties in South Sudan, who had previously sued the previous government of Mr. Kiir over the legality of the creation of the states on Monday, insists the 28 states issue is not realistic.
If all of us fail to agree in the committee on the 28 states, then we will have to return to the former 10 states.
Ellen Margaret Loy, the United Nations Special Representative of the Secretary General in South Sudan, told the media in Juba that unless the transitional government, which comprises of all the parties to the conflict in the country, resolves the issue of the 28 states, the United Nations and the international community does not recognize the 28 states.
It's very clear that there are challenges around the country in relation to how the borders have been drawn in the 28 states proposal, and that has led to ethnic tensions in many parts of the country. First and foremost, I would say that the situation in what was the former Upper Nile state around Malakal is particularly sensitive because of the ethnic composition of the population in that area. And in the meantime, we are not formally recognizing the 28 states.
And that report was compiled by Wahi Simon Wudu in Juba. And now we join the Learning by Ear team for a second chance to hear this week's instalment in our radio drama series, Crime Fighters.
Deutsche Welle, Learning by Ear. Listen up, shape your future.
Crime Fighters.
Thanks for tuning in to Crime Fighters, Drugs to Cure, Drugs to Kill, by Mukoma Wangugi. This is the 8th and final episode, Surviving the Mountaintop. The investigations into Peter's death have led the detectives into the murky world of fake drugs, where very powerful people have been making huge amounts of money. Before taking his own life, Peter's father told the detectives that the president of Ketagu had ordered Peter's death. The president's personal doctor, Kamkuta, has a score to settle with him. So he provided evidence of the president's involvement in the counterfeit drug trade. Kamkuta also arranged for Detective Kalumba and his colleague Salamisha to have an audience with President Gomobo.
It took us almost an hour to get through the security to go and see the president. We'd never been to the State House before, and the elegant surroundings made me very conscious of my cheap suit and shoes. Even Salamisha seemed less confident than usual. I started to feel really nervous when we were disarmed. No one carrying a loaded gun gets to see the president, unless they're part of a security detail. So we were feeling small, intimidated, and vulnerable as we entered the magnificent office where President Gomobo was seated at his desk, sipping whiskey. He offered us both a glass, and of course we couldn't say no.
Thank you, Mr. President. What can I do for you, detectives?
I'm afraid there's no easy way to bring this up.
That's why I gave you the drink, for courage.
Well, the thing is, Mr. President, your name has come up in the course of our investigations. A young man by the name Peter was murdered with cyanide. It was carefully packaged in capsules that were switched with his regular medicine.
Yes, I'm aware of the epidemic of counterfeit drugs. I've been working very closely with the Minister of Health on this.
Yes, well, you see, his name came up too. After Peter was murdered, one of Baba Peter's employees, Fuma, was going to give us some information. But he was killed before he was able to do so. The bar where he was killed turned out to be owned by Malinya, a brother to your own personal doctor, Kamkuta.
Ah, yes, I see where you are going. I've heard that Baba Peter killed himself. Very sad. It's the guilt, you see. The conscience can be your own worst enemy. But come, I don't want to waste your time. You know how they say time is money? Here is a check for 500,000 Ketago shillings. How does police chief and deputy police chief sound to you? In 2 or 3 years, we would make a good team, I think. I need people like you by my side.
Mr. President, we want the truth, that's all. And when we have the truth, we want justice.
You already have the truth. The question is, what are you going to do with it?
All those people who've died after buying fake medicines, and Peter and our colleague Chokbank, not even 10 million Ketagu shillings.
You are both intelligent people. You know how this works. I am the president of Ketagu. I have all the power, and I have the money to implement it. You are my employees. You can either be rich or dead. The choice is yours.
I think we're done here, Kalumba.
Where do you think you are going?
Not everyone in the judiciary is corrupt, Mr. President. And there are others in Parliament who will be happy to expose you. I'll give you an alternative. Shut down the fake medicine cartel and resign. You'll get to keep your name and your money.
My dear detectives, it seems you chose the wrong career. You should have been in comedy. Remember the story of David and Goliath? I control both of them. See yourselves out.
Salamisha and I had no choice. We knew the president would come after us. We just didn't expect it to happen so soon. They ambushed us just after we left State House. We were lucky to survive. Both of us were wounded, but we couldn't go to the hospital. They would have got us there too. Instead, we drove our bullet-riddled car straight to the independently owned Ketagu People's Choice TV station. The only way we'd be safe was if the public knew what was going on. The president's security detail didn't take my phone, so I'd been able to secretly record our conversation with the president. Salamisha and I enjoyed our 15 minutes of fame as we were interviewed by all the major media, both national and international. And we weren't the only ones. One day later, back at our office, we had Mary Jane on radio.
Welcome to the show. With us in the studio today is a woman who would like to remain anonymous. Please tell our listeners why.
Well, I own a pharmacy, and a while ago I was approached by some drug dealers. They wanted me to sell fake medicines. I turned them down and I almost paid with my life.
You must have had your reasons for being so brave.
It's simple. I became a pharmacist to help sick people. And fake drugs are dangerous.
Could you please explain to our listeners how our medicine might be fake?
There are lots of possibilities. For example, a piece of chalk might be shaped into a pill and made to look exactly like real medicine. But of course, a piece of chalk isn't going to help the sick person at all. Or sometimes there might be a small amount of medicine in the pills, but not enough.
And what are the risks involved when someone takes counterfeit medicine?
It might have no effect at all, so the health of the sick person doesn't improve. But counterfeit medicine can also make the patient even sicker or make his body resistant to the real medicine, and that makes the illness harder to treat. Some people even die from taking fake medicines.
So what can people do if they want to be sure that the medicine they buy is genuine?
Anyone who wants to be sure has to buy his medicine from a licensed pharmacy. In some countries, it's also possible to send a text message to check whether the drug is genuine.
How does that work?
The package has a label you can scratch off. There's a code underneath, and you can send a free text message with this code to the company that maintains the system. You'll then get an immediate answer telling you whether the drug is genuine or not.
I see. Interesting. Thank you. So, as we've just heard from our guests, there are things we can do to protect ourselves. But there's still a lot that needs to be done on a global level. Better drug legislation, for example, and higher penalties for producing and distributing counterfeit medicine. Stay tuned to hear more about this after the news.
The revelation that the president is involved in the counterfeit medicine trade has sparked massive demonstrations right across the country. University students were the first to take to the streets, and their teachers quickly joined them. Fake pharmacies have started shutting down and many...
Well, we've certainly had an effect. I think we can say our brother Chalkbank has been avenged.
Yes, we've got justice for him and Peter. Now they can rest in peace.
We should go see Mama Peter. Tell her it's all over. Tell her everything.
Yeah, perhaps she'll find comfort in knowing the truth. When you arrived at Mama Peter's shortly after her husband's funeral, she was surrounded by mourners, all dressed in black. And there, standing right at her side, was the preacher. I tried to reach her, but the preacher ushered her into the crowd of mourners. Right before she disappeared into the sea of tears, she turned back to look at me and smiled, a triumphant smile. And suddenly the possibility struck me. Was she letting me know with a nod and a wink that she was faking her mourning? That it was her all along? That she killed her son, Peter, and everyone else? It made sense. With the president and the minister out of the way, she was now in control of the drug empire, and she'd inherited all of the wealth. Her husband and son were dead. Greed, violence, death, money, power, and for what? Just so she could continue making more money, acquiring more power, and killing the sick and vulnerable? Yet I couldn't say for sure it was her. We'd won the first battle, but the war was far from over. Salamisha and I still had plenty of work to do.
So it looks as if Kalumba and Salamisha will be busy for a long time yet. That's it from us, though, for this series, Drugs to Cure, Drugs to Kill. It was written by Mukoma Wangugi. You can find all the episodes on our website, dw.com/crimefighters, and on Facebook. Goodbye.
And now, a reminder of our main stories here on Africa Link before we leave you. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has said Parliament will form a bipartisan committee to discuss the future of the Electoral Commission. South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority is to appeal the reopening of more than 700 corruption charges against President Jacob Zuma. And in South Sudan, there is to be a review of President Salva Kiir's decision to expand the number of states that make up the country from 10 to 28. And there we end this edition of Africa Link. You can contact us by sending an email to feedback.africa@dw.com. A letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany, or an SMS to country code 49160 957 59510. From me, Mark Caldwell. Bye now.